Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ron. I might just, at this stage, not formally, but file a small protest to the organisers in that I think it's jolly unfair that I should be asked to follow Dr. Dobbs. I think that's an act that it's almost impossible to follow. However, I'll attempt to do my best. I've had some discussion in the previous papers about economics, and even money has reared its quite ugly head. And as a starting point, I'm always reminded of what Douglas said about the whole of the money question. It is a form of black magic. And the best way to deal with black magic is to stop believing in it. So in essence, in advancing what we call social credit, we have really got to start with ourselves. And if you can't free yourself from black magic, then you can't help anyone else. Black magic obscures reality, and as we're going to see, what we're going to talk about is releasing reality. It's very potent, black magic, if you believe in it. And so in Australia, we still have, in a few areas where tribal Aboriginals exist, the phenomena of quite healthy Aboriginals having what's called the bone pointed at them by the witch doctor and going away and, for no understandable reason, dying. I want to suggest to you that perhaps many of us are like those Aboriginals. And when the bone is pointed, we go away and in one form or other, we die. So what we're trying to get at is this question which Douglas described in one of those many profound comments. In fact, if nothing demonstrates the genius of Douglas, it's the number of profound observations with which his writings are sprinkled. And you can take just one sentence, and that contains a profound concept that almost needs a number of books to develop. And one of those that made a tremendous impact on me was when Douglas said, we are trying to release reality. And that's the essence of what I want to talk to you about this afternoon. Now, history provides many examples of revolutions concerning great truths being destroyed, not by direct opposition, but by perversion. The most dangerous perversion is that of those who proclaim they're supporting the author of the truth. They are, in fact, perverting. The most dangerous perversion is, I'm going to suggest, in the field of what has already been opened up here today, called Christianity. I'm coming back to that. But also the perversion of social credit itself. We have large numbers of people who call themselves Christians, and I am quite sure genuinely believe they are Christians, followers of Christ, But supporting policies which crush the individual freedom, thus denying the individual the God-given right to develop his most divine attribute, which I describe as his creative initiative. And I suggest to you that the ultimate in blasphemy is the profession of Christian Marxism and support for a world state, a type of international Caesar, imposing what would in reality be a frozen hell. Many of those describing themselves as social creditors have, as we've already seen, misrepresented Douglass and social credit by, in some cases, describing Douglass as a great idealist and social credit as a plan of monetary reform. The famous Semitic Jewish writer, I have deliberately used that term, Semitic Jewish writer, distinguished from others, Dr. Oscar Levy, in a little book, very profound book, called The Idiocy of Idealism, made what I regard as the profound observation that the ideal is the enemy of the real. Idealism is a manifestation of man's false pride and suggests that man can be his own God, that he knows what ought to be, instead of accepting that which is. Michael Weller touched on this, and I don't think we can ponder on it too often or too deeply. The two approaches to looking at the world. Malcolm Muggeridge touches on it in his brilliant essay, The Great Liberal Death Wish. And that view is that man in his own mind can conceive of some ideal and then insist he's going to make it a reality, irrespective of whether it in fact partakes of reality or not. In the field of the natural sciences, we can see that what Douglass said about the rules of the universe transcending human thinking, we can see those more clearly, because there's a more direct relationship between cause and effect. Now, the idealist may say, I don't like what's called the law of gravity. It's very uncomfortable. It causes accidents and much else. He can hold that view. But as we all know, irrespective of what he believes, if he continues to jump over the cliff, you'll always get the same result. And again, as I was saying earlier, we sometimes go to the poets to get a type of insight on some of these matters, and I often quote the famous statement by G.K. Chesterton, who said that the man who jumps over the cliff not only violates the law of gravity, he demonstrates the truth of the law. And the plight of the world today, to me, is a graphic demonstration. There are absolutes, and as Douglass said, if we want satisfaction, we'd better adopt a different approach, which is one of humility. In other words, the attitude of the true scientist who attempts to discover that which is, not what he thinks it ought to be. So therefore, Douglass was not an idealist in that sense at all. He was a realist. In an illuminating word picture of Douglass, our late friend, Mr. Dennis Byrne, wrote this, and I quote, "It was the basis of Douglass's philosophy, of which social credit is the policy, that there is running through the warp and woof of the universe the law of righteousness, divine law, which he termed the canon. Because of the higher intelligence and free will accorded to him, man cannot rely on instinct to guide him in his adherence to the canon. He must seek it actively, and to the extent that he finds it and he conforms to it, he will achieve harmony with the universe and his creator. Conversely, to the degree that he ignores the operation of the canon and flouts it, he will bring disaster upon himself." Byrne continued, "It was inherent in Douglass's writing that he viewed society as something partaking of the nature of an organism which could, quoting, have life and life more abundant, end of quote, to the extent that it was God-centered and obedient to his canon. Within it, that is the organism, the sovereignty of God, the creator of all things visible and invisible, being absolute, there must be full recognition of the sanctity of human personality and therefore of the individual person, free to live his life and within the body social, to enter into or contract out of such associations as with responsibility to his creator he may choose. And no person may deny to another this relationship to God and his fellow man without committing sacrilege. This concept, reflecting the ideal of Christendom as the integration of church and society, which was the inspiration of European civilization for centuries, involves adherence to a policy in every sphere of social life, economic, political, and cultural. This is the policy, which Douglass terms social credit. And Dennis Byrne continued and concluded, "Looking out upon the world with a clarity of vision, which was unique in his time, Douglass saw a doomed civilization committed to the opposite policy, stemming from a conflicting philosophy, a philosophy which deified man and sought to subjugate the world to him." End of quote. What a different picture we have of Douglass compared with that which presents him as merely another reformer. The plight of the world today is, I put it to you, a measure of the widespread rejection of that absolute we call God. Because men come to believe or cease to believe in God, does not mean, as many think, they believe in nothing. The truth is that when they cease to believe in absolutes, they then are free to believe in every type of incredible nonsense which the mind of man can produce. And there's many manifestations of that today. Irrespective of how pleasant and superficially civilized that person I call the liberal humanist may be, he is the advance force paving the way for the totalitarian barbarians. I'd like you to think about that. He is the advance guard. The liberal humanist himself is, as I say, pleasant. And because an individual is pleasant, people do not associate that with evil. The truth is that some of the greatest evil in the world is imposed by extremely pleasant individuals. Solzhenitsyn gives us an example of this, I often quote it, of the Soviet judge who was an individual, was quite pleasant, urbane, superficially civilized, library full of all the great classics, listened only to classical music. When he walked, he admired nature, the birds, the trees, patted the little children on the head. The same man, said Solzhenitsyn, sent tens of thousands to the hell of the concentration camps, believing he was doing good. That is the ultimate in evil. Liberal humanism is a subtle, corrosive poison which saps the strength of the master building, weakening the structure of orderly society. The great Cicero, he tried to warn in vain his fellow Romans that the Roman civilization was threatened by an erosion of belief in values rooted in the natural law philosophy, so brilliantly enunciated by the Greek genius Aristotle. As the term implies, the natural law philosophy, which had such a profound influence on St. Thomas Aquinas and other early Christian philosophers, accepted that there are absolutes which men ignore at their peril. Cicero's fellows ignored his warnings, and eventually, as we know, the barbarians picked their way through the ruins of once, which was the glory of Rome. It was the liberal humanists who created the climate in which the first great modern revolution, that in France, burst upon Western Christendom. Most of those who paved the way for that revolution were themselves eventually devoured by the destructive forces they had helped to unlash. But there's an old saying that the road to hell is paved with very good intentions. Attempts to build utopias by well-meaning idealists inevitably end in disaster. And for that reason, I think we have to get our minds around the fact it's not so much the communist barbarian who threatens us, but the liberal humanist who, rejecting absolutes, is destroying the walls of the city of our civilization. The barbarians merely flood through later. Douglas said this concerning utopias and the building of them and idealism. And this is something again to ponder on, and it astonishes some people who merely associate social credit with attacks on bankers. And bankers are very bad. Douglas said, when we accuse the world's great financiers of being merely conscienceless buccaneers, there is a sense in which we do them less than justice, and at the same time fail to recognize the deadly danger which they embody. The great financier is in most cases a great idealist, and sooner or later constructs a utopia which it is his constant endeavor to impose upon the world. Society, said Douglas, is never in more deadly danger than when it is committed to the mercies of the idealist, and particularly the utopianist. The fact is that there is no single utopia which would give satisfaction to more than a small percentage of us. And that what we really demand of existence is not that we shall be put into someone else's utopia, but that we shall, in fact, be put into a position to create a utopia of our own. And this idea of a centrally controlled world in which everybody lives under the same uniform conditions, elaborated on the basis of statistics, either of the census or otherwise, is at the back of the drive which is being made to induce us to believe that the world can be considered as a single unit. Cultures, climate, tradition, race, and habits all give the lie to this idea. And as the human personality develops, it in fact becomes more specialized and individualized in its outlook, and is less amenable to centralized direction. End of quote. The idealist who strives to use the state to impose his particular utopia is denying the fundamental aspect of the Christian revelation concerning the uniqueness of each individual. The doctrine that all men are equal, now extended, I might say, to the remarkable claim that even men and women are equal, was one of the major legacies of the French Revolution. The meaning of equality, of course, is no quality at all. All programs for centralized planning require that individuals be treated as statistics. But all such programs produce disastrous results because they're contrary to reality. The Soviet planners have discovered this with their ideal of collectivized farming, with every Russian farmer working for that abstraction called the common good, not the personal gain. Eventually, even the Soviet planners had to make some concessions to reality, permitting the farmers to have small private plots for their own personal production. Production, as we know, on these small plots is enormously greater relatively than on the collectivized farm. Some years ago, this cleavage between idealism and realism was brought home to me when a young university-produced farm advisor in Australia, a supporter of the philosophy that farmers should get bigger or get out, took exception to my critical comments on Soviet collectivized farming. The young man hotly denied that collectivized farming was doomed to failure. And when I asked him what had gone wrong then in the Soviet Union, he answered that the problem, and I quote him, was the stupid, ignorant, bloody Russian peasants. That was the problem. The problem, in essence, was reality. That young man did not like to admit that the reality of human nature cannot be forced to submit to idealistic planning schemes. He, in essence, was saying he knew better than God. So therefore, in a very realistic sense, Solzhenitsyn is correct when he says the basic cause of the disintegration of our civilization has been the growing loss of faith in God, and correctly says there must be a return to a belief in God, God the absolute. But here again, so many of our Christian friends miss the point which Douglas made, and it's already been touched upon, but I'd just like to come back to it. Douglas stressed that merely stating that you believe in something does not of itself make anything happen. You have to devise appropriate mechanisms. He gave me, I must confess, a completely new concept of the doctrine of incarnation. And he gave an example, which I'm sure we can all readily understand, and as an engineer we can understand perhaps why he used this. And he put forward this conception that, supposing many, many years ago, someone had discovered a truth called thermodynamics. And supposing, he said, a whole movement was built up of people who went around saying and professing our belief in thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is the way to the better life. Well, as he points out, millions of people could go around expressing belief in that truth, but if someone did not relate those truths through the appropriate mechanisms, the engines, then the truths make nothing happen at all. In other words, you've got to incarnate that truth so that those truths then are used to drive great ships. It's worth thinking about, because it is a different approach. Therefore, large numbers of Christians do go still to church, profess the creeds, but nothing happens. Nothing happens. All they're saying is they accept the truth, but they do nothing about incarnating the truth. In other words, no effort is made, as Michael Weller said, to ensure that the Word does become flesh. Douglas, again on this subject, shed, as on so many other subjects, such a blinding light. Therefore, when he moved on and talked about practical Christianity, he spoke of a Christianity which lives through the actions of individuals, as individuals and together in society, so that those truths can be released. Another famous statement, Douglas, referring to social credit, said, we have glimpsed a portion of reality. And what we're striving to do is to relate our actions to that glimpse so we can make it real. One of the problems we have, many of you know this, in discussing why we are where we are, is whether you accept what has come to be known as the conspiratorial theory of history, which is sneered at, which in essence suggests that what has happened is inevitable. And every person who accepts that is then a victim here of that idea. He is paralyzed because if what's happened is inevitable, there's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes been referred to as the village idiot theory of history. Now, if we can reverse it, I hope no one would reject the view, and I put this often to those that reject what they are pleased to call the conspiratorial view, no one would reject the view that Western Christendom just happened, that like Topsy, it just grew. Those truths enunciated by Christ which gave us a glimpse of reality we'd never had before, had to be released. Appropriate mechanisms had to be devised. And we see this through the growth of Western Christendom, and particularly into the area which Douglas touched on and mentioned here today, of our constitutional arrangements. And I am one of those who believe this is one of the most fundamental questions that social creditors should be discussing. Douglas said again, either constitutionalism, which is a set of rules, either it partakes of reality and therefore is real and works, or it doesn't. And to the extent we used to have constitutions which did work and serve the individual, they did partake of Christian truths. And that didn't happen by chance. It required the effort of myriads of individual Christians as individuals, and eventually through associations over thousands of years, nearly 2,000, to ensure a new type of civilization developed. And just as that civilization did not just happen, so what is happening to that civilization hasn't just happened either. In other words, individuals are responsible for history. It's individuals who are responsible for policies. And if men come together to promote a particular philosophy and the appropriate policies, they are in one sense conspiring, or they are coming together. This again, you see, is going back to reality, and that's what we've got to be clear about. Perhaps before we conclude, we should go on and say a few words on the subject of releasing reality and stress the problem, as I said earlier, that reality is obscured by a type of black magic when we refer to finance or money. In other words, as St. Paul put it, it is the love of money, it's not money itself. That's only an abstraction, whether it's those squiggles that Dr. Dodd spoke about, or pound notes, or bits of paper, bits of metal. It's the love of it, the worship of an abstraction. It was that that St. Paul clearly referred to when he said, it's the root of all evil, the root of all evil, the worship of abstractionism, because that obscures reality. And so therefore, if social credit is to grow, it's only going to be a result of enough individuals seeing through that black magic to the reality behind it. And here Douglas again shed such light on the economic question as we've discussed. Take the simplest example. The realist, if we're going to build a bridge, would ask this question: have we got enough building materials? Have we got the manpower? Have we got the expertise? Have we got the food to feed them? And if the answer is yes, then we can build a bridge. But those that worship the abstraction called money, they don't ask that question. They first ask, have we got enough of something they're pleased to call financial resources? And if some witch doctor says no, there are not enough of those, we don't build the bridge. We're denied access to reality. Words themselves are symbols which can either be used correctly to reflect reality or can be used to obscure it. The great Francis Bacon, whom one would have to describe as one of the great geniuses a Western man, appealed for what he called a just relationship between the mind and things. And it's words that we use. And if we worship the words, then we can reach the stage that there's a breakdown in understanding of reality. And as I've pondered on this, and these are personal reflections, which I merely share with you, and to find these outlined in this little book, Is the Word Enough? I find that one of the great problems of my fellow Christians is they will enter into long and sometimes quite bitter dispute about words without any attempt to reflect on the reality behind the words. They are really worshippers of the word. The Pharisees were great worshippers of the word, endless disputation, and you've got plenty of that today. Douglas said concerning Christianity, we haven't even started to perceive the tremendous concept, the truth. And to a great extent, that reality has been hidden by this concentration on words. It's always interested me that Christ himself did not leave himself any written record. He didn't have a type of, like Boswell, with a scribe going around. And there's enormous things that he did we know about, as you'll read in St. John, particularly the last verse. The world would be full of books if we had to describe everything. So what are we looking for? And I'm going to suggest to you that running through the whole theme of the four Gospels is the necessity for works. Truth is released in works, not in professing faith and belief in this or that, but in works. St. James said, we must be doers of the word, doers of it. The true scientist, I think, is one that provides us with a model. And first of all, I'd like to say this, there's enormous superstition about what's called science, enormous superstition about what science has discovered, or science has done this, or science has invented this. The truth is that science merely, or the true scientist merely discovers that which is. He doesn't create anything. He doesn't create reality. He doesn't create truth. It is part of absolute, that absolute we call God. What he does then is to arrange those truths in such a manner that they benefit the individual. We release reality. So even when we laymen talk about generating electricity as if we create electricity, we do nothing of the kind. What we do is to establish certain relationships which makes available forces that were there. Now, if we can get our minds around this, we can see there's a tremendous potential there for individual social credits, to the extent they come to an understanding of this. As we deepen our faith and our understanding and base our lives on that constant search for truth as we discover it, then social creditors are in the vanguard of what I would call not only the regeneration of our civilization, but with great respect, I believe that social credit is absolutely essential for the further growth of what we call Christianity. Thank you very much.